This is a continuation of the interview with Emeritus Professor Niels Ingerson, November 6, 2006. Niels, you're back in Madison now from UCLA.
I'm back in Madison, and it seems that my career is taking a turn here. Because for some years I have been quite interested in folklore, especially folk tales, narrative folklore. And had incorporated a number of tales in my passages. I've always been interested in structure, the way a literary work is structured, and folk tales is a wonderful specimen there because you can see how tales are built up. So I started teaching a class at Scandinavian Studies called the Scandinavian Tale and Ballad, which was a folklore class, although I don't have much background in folklore, but if you stick to narrative folklore only, you can use your literary acumen. However, after I got back to Madison, let me backtrack here. Shortly before I left for LA, three people contacted me, Jim Bailey from Slavics, Harold Shaw from African, and Narayan Rao from Southeast Asia Studies. And they were toying with the idea of starting a folklore program. And they wondered whether I would be interested. And I said, yes, of course. So together we started this folklore program and got permission to do so from the dean, from Dean Cronon. However, we would be on probation for 2 years. The deans had to see whether it worked out, whether there was an enrollment or not. In order to become legit, I sat in on Harold Schreib's class on the folk tale. It was fun because Studentor is his TA. So I took notes and I learned an awful lot because Schreib is a marvelous teacher and he tells very good stories. That gave me a background, so I could take all of his class the following year. So now I taught for the folklore program the folk tale. And programs, you know, are peculiar outfits because they don't have a budget. It's composed of volunteers for various departments. And if you have a budget, it's for sort of maybe a student who takes the phone and things like that, you know, a few times a week. But programs need directors or chairs too. So in 89, I think, or 87, I forget exactly which year, 87, I think, I became the director of folklore, which was easier than being a chair for a department because you don't have to worry about the budgets. But you have to worry about getting a batch of courses together. And there you found that small departments were often cooperative, but big departments were not. They wanted their young teachers to teach one-on-one or whatever. So it was a bit of a headache. But also it was fun. And gradually I started attending folklore conferences and giving papers to see whether I could have it. Huh. But since then, I published about 8-9 articles in folklore, and right now I have a book arrangement with a publisher. So I'm supposed to be working on a book on narrative folklore.
Did you find when you came back from UCLA that folklore was in fact flourishing?
It was, because we got a grant from NEH. And that helps an awful lot. When you have money like that and can propose new courses, you are legitimate. And the courses were very popular. People streamed to folklore. Students took a liking to it right away. So the folklore program has been doing well.
Were you able to offer a major at that time?
No, that took some time. You have to propose that through Letters and Science, and that is a sort of laborious process. Mm-hmm. I think you started with a minor, then a few years ago, I think you got a major, and they always talk about transforming the program into a department, and whether that will work or not, I don't quite know. But the present chair, Jim Leary, who is very, very competent, is funded, I think, halfway through the folklore program. So there is a budget now for faculty. So slowly, it is emerging, I think, it will eventually be a department, I think. because he's doing very well, and Leary, as I said, is a very good leader. He's now been the director for, I think, 7 years, so he needs somebody else to take over.
Yeah.
You always say when you're chair director, it should be 3 years max. Otherwise, you're senile in the job or something like that.
Now, you came back and you were teaching in folklore, but I assume you were also still teaching in Scandinavian studies.
Oh, yes. When I first came, I suggested, I think I said that the first day we talked, a graduate course called Survey of Scandinavian Lit.
Yes.
We started at the very beginning and more all the way up. And that course I remained responsible for. So I had 4 semesters roughly there,
uh-huh.
A 2-year cycle. So that I had to do. And then I had my master thesis class and my Hans Christian Andersen class. So I was pretty booked up.
Not teaching Danish?
No, luckily. Younger people took that over. I'm not a good language teacher, I get bored. Because the sameness of it all, you know, doesn't intrigue me. So younger people are much, much better language teachers. Yeah. And I think most teachers agree about that. Young people, young TAs who teach the course for 2 or 3 years and then hand it over to somebody else. I think that's the best thing.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's very good training for that. It is. I mean, people who want PhDs, who want to teach, have to have a lot of training while they're here at the universities. Another thing that happened that made my life busy was that it was suggested that I and Faith, my wife, should take over as editors of a learned journal, Scandinavian Studies. And you always object to that because you know it's going to be very time consuming. But to do a decent job, it'll take a lot of your time. On the other hand, it's an interesting job and a job that has to be done. So we talked about it, Faith and I, and decided we would tackle the job for about 5 years.
Now, who asked you to do this?
Well, Scandinavian, the Society for the Advancement of Scandinavian Study consists of about 300-400 people, Scandinavian studies in this country and Canada. And as I told you, I think today, for the weekend, we meet once a year at various universities.
Okay.
And there's a steering group, and a vice president, and a president. And that steering group approached us and asked us to do this, and those who asked us were good friends, so it's hard to say no. That journal is a bit of a mixed bag because Scandinavian studies is a small field compared to English and French and Spanish and whatnot. So the journal publishes articles in philology, linguistics, Old Norse, literature, history, and we expanded that to include art history too. So it's a very mixed bag, so you need competent people to evaluate the articles. All articles submitted are refereed by 2 people. And the editors have to find those 2 people. And if the article isn't accepted by these so-called readers, evaluators, then we publish it. Often with revisions, which we ask for, and so on, so on, so on. We split the job between us. Not all Scandinavianists write equally good English. So now and then stylistic changes were necessary.
And the journal is published entirely in English?
Entirely in English, but with quotations in Scandinavian languages.
I see that.
So, Faith did the main editing of the articles, the commas and the hyphens and the spelling and whatnot. And my job was to find the right evaluators and to write those letters to well-known scholars and tell them, sorry, your article has not been accepted.
Yeah.
It's been rejected for the following reasons. That would be a very ticklish job to write those articles. And we rejected quite a few articles because we thought that it was our job to to sort of heighten the quality of the publication. It was interesting, got to know an awful lot of people that way, and talk with those older people and whatnot, and that equals a very good talent.
And did you make enemies?
Yeah, sure. There were some people who didn't talk to you for several years. Mm-hmm. Oh yes, and people who wrote angry letters and whatnot, but that's a part of the game, it's the name of the game, so to speak. You have to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
Then...
Was it stressful for you and Faith as husband and wife to do this, or was it fun?
No, we always, it was fun actually, it was. We've written two books together,
uh-huh.
So we're used to working together.
Uh-huh.
And also, when I write something in English, Faith always takes it out, because I can easily make a mistake. Wrong pronoun or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So we have worked together for years and years and years, so that was not difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also why we agreed to accept the job. We knew that part of it would be okay.
Now, did the journal accept any political writing about contemporary affairs in Scandinavia?
Yes. There were articles about, say, welfare state and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
And we... And that was a bit controversial. We had theme issues, special issues,
oh.
Often large issues that cost extra money to publish,
uh-huh.
About the welfare state, about the health system in Scandinavia, about Anglo-Saxon Old Norse connections. Every year there was an issue like that. And that meant that the reviews, we also reviewed books, piled up. Because in those special issues, we only had reviews that were pertinent to the main theme. So we got a bit behind with reviews, and some members of the society objected to that. So we get criticism, okay. But that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. And we also got actually quite a few articles sent to us by European scholars. So it became sort of an international journal during our tenure, I think. More people noticed it.
Okay.
Somehow. These theme issues made them up. People noticed those theme issues.
Is this the most important journal for a student of Scandinavia to be published in?
In America, yes. It is. There's no doubt about it. There are other journals that also accept articles about Scandinavian studies. They are German journals too. I mean, they have a Scandinavian section or something like this. This is the only journal really devoted to Scandinavian studies in this country. So yes, it is often the place where young scholars publish their first article. I strayed away from the journal when I first came here because I wanted to make a name for myself in Scandinavia. I thought I was going back, but now I knew I was not going back.
Uh-huh. I assume that you've been published in the journal periodically.
Yes, I have periodically, and I publish quite a few reviews in Scandinavian studies too, and even during my own tenure, because a colleague of mine from Berkeley suggested we should have folklore sessions, pre-conference folklore meetings.
Oh.
So for a number of years we met one day early, on Thursday or Wednesday, something like this. At the university, we had this the yearly conference.
Uh-huh.
And he invited us to come to Berkeley and give papers for one whole day. And that we did, and that was kind of fun. We more or less gave papers for each other. There were very few students attended because they were taking classes. But that made room for a very sort of, I would say, sophisticated discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And the papers were very good. So, this Berkeley scholar, John Lindau is his name, sent the whole batch of papers to me as the editor and suggested these papers be published, which we did.
Oh.
So I even managed to publish an article of my own when I was tenure. Because I was not the one who submitted it.
Very clever.
Yeah. Sure.
So you were doing that at the same time that you were heading folklore.
Yeah. Yes,
working quite hard.
Working quite hard. I was still teaching 3 3/4, you know. So I was teaching third time in folklore and 2/3 time in Scandinavian studies, basically. Oh yeah, the years fled by. The time went very, very fast.
You're just very busy. I could see you doing 2 out of those 3 things, but to be doing all 3 was quite a phenomenal commitment.
It was too much.
Uh-huh.
It was too much.
I'm not criticizing.
No, no.
I'm just observing.
But I also realized that that article or that book I wanted to write was gathering dust on the shelves in my study. So you always neglect a part of your career, it seems.
Uh-huh.
That's nearly inevitable. And most of my colleagues would agree with that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it was with a sigh of relief that we stepped down as editors in 19.
Uh-huh.
One thing that happened that time was that you changed from old-fashioned typesetting to computer typesetting. And you had to read proofs of the whole journey. That took a long time, and I faced it most of that. It's very good at that. You had to catch all those errors.
Mm-hmm.
They were always preparing typesetting.
Yes.
And you can't trust the authors to catch their own errors and proofs.
No.
Scholars are lousy proofreaders because if there's a misspelling, they don't see it. In their head, they spell it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to double check. Then came computer typesetting. And it seemed so much easier. But there are so many problems connected with computers. We were publishing our last issue, and somehow the signal was sent, delete all last lines of the whole journey, of the whole issue. We luckily caught it in time, but you know that we realized that the computer is going to create problems, so goodbye. but then computers entered our own lives, and it's amazing to think that so many, the first 2 books we wrote, and so many articles were done on an old Hermes typewriter, now sitting in the attic site collecting dust.
Mm-hmm.
Dust. I came home from Denmark, the usual summer trip, in late August and found a computer on my desk in my office in Manhattan. And I asked other people, what's going on here? And the folklore was that Dean Cronin had gotten a very good deal with the computer company and therefore bought computers to all faculty members who did not have computers. So they were dumped on your desk. And earlier you somehow resisted using them. You're scared of these new things.
Yes.
But now you're sitting there in front of you, so you started using it. First it's a typewriter, and then slowly you learned, you know, the tricks of the trade.
Mm-hmm. So you were compelled to join the computer age at the UW.
There was no way out. There was no way out. And the same went for my colleagues, and started talking about, you know, and giving us other advice, bad advice very often, but the computer age had arrived. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
This is 1990?
Yeah, it's around there. It is. And students who went abroad, we always have some students abroad, Norway, Sweden, Denmark,
mm-hmm.
or Fulbright or whatever. They started emailing you. And email was very problematic in the beginning because you could not correct mistakes.
Yes.
You had to retype your mistake. And again, here was the vulnerable. You could talk to your student in Copenhagen. It was kind of fun. Instead of having no long distance transatlantic phone calls that were expensive.
Yeah.
And also this thing called fax arrived.
Uh-huh.
I think it was one place only at the university you could send a fax and receive a fax, but
really
life was changing.
Irritating. Yes.
And I realized that in earnest when I became chair again.
Yes, I think that's so interesting. you gave up editing the journal, yeah, and you stepped right into being chair.
Yeah, but the reason is the only so many people is getting their studies. And none of us really want to be chair. We all prefer not to. That somebody else will do the job, because it is time consuming. But you know, when you only have that many faculty members, you have to take turns. I mean, in English and history, you will have new people become chairs. You only have to chair once. But in small departments like Continent or Hebrew Studies, Canadian Studies, sooner or later, you have to be chair again. Mm-hmm. And it was simply my turn.
I see.
Yeah. Kim Nilsson, who I mentioned earlier, had been chair for 3 years, and he was kind enough to take another extra year, a fourth year, because as editor of Scandinavian Studies. But now I couldn't say, sorry. So I had to become chair again. But it proved to be a good experience. First of all, when I created the budget, I didn't have to use this library. You can use smart technology.
Yeah.
Also, the letters you have to write, you can do that on the computer. When you have to change something on page one, you didn't have to go to your secretary and say, could you retype this? You do it yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, the computer was problematic, but also made life much, much easier. Huh. And also, it's easier to write those afterwards, because you would play with language now. Instead of having three drafts on the typewriter, mm-hmm, you would play and play and play. Mm-hmm. It became more fun. It became sort of a whimsical fun to compose something.
Didn't you care, though, that you lost your drafts?
Well, I wasn't paperless. I have drafts, that's a draft, that's a draft.
Okay.
Yeah, now and then I lost something. Of course, I did. Everybody did. But, you know, I was very careful with that. You know, because I heard horror stories about a novelist in the English department. I think her name was Cherry or something like this.
Kelly Cherry.
She lost the whole draft of another novel. That's what I heard, at least. And there's university folklore.
Yeah. Yes, there is, isn't there?
I mean, I'll give you one example, which I always use in my folklore classes. Why are there only three elevators in Van Hyde's hall? Students ask me that because you obviously have to stand and wait and wait and wait for the elevator to grab to the 13th floor or come down for your class. You have to leave for Bascom for class, and you know you're going to be late. Mm-hmm. But you wait and wait and wait endlessly. I mean, can we talk about this? So, I heard when I came to Van Hyde's in 67 that it's because it decided in the last moment to put the administration on top of the modern language building. There were only supposed to be 14 floors. Now we have 19. It was too late to add an elevator. Now, whether this is true or not, I have no idea. But it's Van Hyde's folklore. These stories were told. Then some people told me that there is another elevator. These administrators who dress up in their ties every day, they have their own elevator that goes to the parking garage. So I went in there and looked. There was no elevator. But I went to the 15th floor, and there's an elevator there that takes you up to 16, 17, 18, 19. Mm-hmm. So there is an elevator, but not one that, you know, brings you down to the garage. So this I always tell to my students in my folklore classes, to point out that folklore is everywhere. Also in your own lives.
That's so interesting. Yeah. I certainly, when I was working with Catherine Lyle, heard several stories about the lack of elevators in Van Hyde.
Sure.
And the primary story that I heard was that the state legislature had eliminated one elevator to reduce the cost of the building or to punish the university. I mean, I have no idea if it's true, but, you know, you're right. Everybody's standing around waiting for an elevator.
Sure. So. There's so many stories, and one of these days you probably give a paper on this at the conference.
Yes. That's a conference I'll come to.
Okay, all right. That's a deal.
I take it from something that you said earlier. Your department was collegial.
Yes.
So yes. Being chair you were not inundated with personnel problems.
No. I mean, we have these lectures coming in, one in the three languages.
Uh-huh.
And they are there for 2 or 3 years, and there could be some problems at times there. I mean, some people fit in beautifully, they get colleagues right away, and some never really understood how the department functions and so on. So there could be problems there, and there could be problems now in the TAs.
I see.
Not everybody's born pedagogue. And now and then students came and complained. And we also had a historian in the department years ago who was 60% Scandinavian of studies and 40% history. He then switched full time to history because he felt sort of alienated, too alone in Scandinavian studies.
Oh.
And with that person, he had some problems.
Uh-huh.
Some students complained about him, and I said, as chair, I'd be happy to do something about it, but I want it in the writing, not by hearsay. And somehow students are very scared to do anything in writing.
Oh.
So you couldn't do much about that.
That's very smart, isn't it?
Yeah. You have to have it in writing. Hearsay is a terrible thing. Rumor is a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll get into that later because, I mean, my colleagues and I more or less retired at the same time within 2 years. And of course, that means a generational shift.
Mm-hmm.
And the new people move in, you know, it takes a while to establish a milieu, to get to know each other very, very well, so you can work well together. It takes time.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, it's a fine department, but it's not the same mood or climate as we had earlier.
Mm-hmm.
These younger people have to figure it out.
Interesting. This concludes side 2 of tape 4. This is tape number 5, side 1 of the ongoing interview with Emeritus Professor Niels Ingwersen. You were talking about your second tenure as chair of the department.
Sure.
And needing things in writing before you could take action.
Right. There were no major cases. I mean, it was petty little things, but there are petty things in one's lives. But generally, I enjoyed my second term as chair, but partly because I tried it before. It was easier.
Uh-huh.
It was easier. And partly because I thought that Southall, the deans, were very careful listeners and tried to accommodate me. When Don Crawford was associate dean, I and a few other department vice chairs or summer chairs or whatever asked to talk to him about reducing our course load because we said, you know, 3-3, that's a bit much. Could we do 3-2 instead? I mean, go down one course every other semester?
Mm-hmm.
And he listened very carefully and said, if you can still have a viable program, still, you know, service your students, then you can do it. So draw me a proposal.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, and he okayed, or had Cronin okay, or drop down from 3-3 to 3-2. And that helped a lot.
That helped a lot. Did.
Then when he became dean, when Cronin retired, Don Crawford very, very soon pointed out that there should be equality among the departments. Everybody should teach 2-2. Sort of by demand. So now we all taught 2-2. And somehow it worked out. Well, as I told you earlier, in Scandinavian studies, chairs don't drop a course. They could do it if they wanted to, but they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And also, now and then, when you feel it's necessary, you teach an extra course. Or your team teach a course.
Mm-hmm.
Teach a third, and a third, and a third, or something like this. So somehow we managed.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that made my life easier was that the associate dean was Sarge Bush from English. And he was my favorite dean.
Really?
Yeah. Because he listened very carefully to you. He took notes, and he always remembered what you said. I mean, I had some deans with very faulty memories. You always had to refresh my memories, not push. And he was incredibly fair. I mean, of course he said no to some of the proposals, but I also really told you why. So to have a, I mean, and mainly you deal with the associate dean, you don't deal with the major dean.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
You don't get in with
the not dean very often. I mean, yes, now and then, but not very often. Uh-huh. So you, as a chair, you see the associate dean, you know, once a month or something like this. So you have a give and take there, which is very, very important.
So the associate dean is actually an important person.
Very important person. Very important person. And is the often the associate dean who really understands your department, what's going on there. For instance, Sue Bradley, who joined the department about 50 years ago, she took over the suits position. She married her TA, eventually, Scott Mellor. So he's now a spouse and hire. Or became eventually a spouse and hire. So when he was chair, he could not discuss his situation with the associate dean. So I became that chair who talked about that lecturer because he was married to our chair. It can get very complicated, but it's the associate deans who understand these mechanisms and remember them. So it's very important you have an associate dean who really understands what's going on in the department and push it.
Is the dynamic such that generally the dean of the college, when presented with the problem, will hand it to the associate dean? If something came up in Scandinavian studies or physics or...
I think that the deans normally know when there are problems. I think a person like Cronin knew that department is troubled and that department is troubled. It's nearly inevitable that they figure out.
I see.
Also because some faculty members go to deans and complain. They shouldn't, I think, but they do. I can return to that later on. But there are people, I mean, Cobb Lippers, you know, had a tremendous problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the senior faculty there, and they did not get along with each other, bypassed the chair and went to the dean directly. Not the associate dean, but the real dean.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the major dean, the dean of the exercise, would like the associate dean to handle the problem, if he or she can do it, with the department.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, in Scandinavian studies, we did not have any of those problems.
Yes.
Yeah. But I know about other departments that had such problems.
Yes.
And that can be very time consuming for all associate deans and deans to handle these nasty infightings.
And it does seem to me, actually, and this is sort of an uninformed comment, there is some vicious, very unpleasant relationships within the academic community.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if it's more so than other organizations, but maybe it's just that we tend to think that they don't happen.
Yeah, we believe the true, the good, and the beautiful, you know, and teach about art and so on. We should be above all this. Of course, we aren't.
Yes.
Yeah. And since I have evaluated other Scandinavian departments elsewhere in the country, I have certainly seen this. And now then, when you are alone with a faculty member, it all comes out.
Uh-huh.
My colleagues did that to me, and my colleagues don't respect me, and all this comes out. Don't dare say it in public, so to speak. When you sit there as a judge from another university, you hear an awful lot of dirt.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure that comes out here too.
Yeah. I have to tell you this. I mean, we have made reference before to your wonderful holiday party that Scandinavian Studies do, and it should be acknowledged on record. But it was Phil Certain, when he was dean, at one of the deans, the dean would meet with foundation staff. And this was toward the end of the year, and he said, now, who has Scandinavian studies? And I said, well, I do. He said, well, are you going to the party? I said, what party? He said, Scandinavian studies has the best holiday party on campus. He said, if you've not been with the department, you get over there and see if you can't get an invitation.
Well, I'm touched. I'm touched, Rudy.
What is the history of that party?
Well,
and is it, in fact, the best on campus?
It's very, very popular. And people come from, you know, across the street to it. And deans come to it. So, it is a popular party. Partly because we serve this Swedish concoction called glögg, you know. That doesn't hurt. But the history is pretty simple, I think, because when I first came here, we had a wonderful secretary called Mrs. Nielsen, Danish descent. And she was sort of an old toughy, and she thought that Kim Nielsen and I and Dick Ringler were her boys, because she was, you know, 25 years older. So she sort of adopted us. But she retired in, I think, 76. She broke her leg. And then we hired a young woman called Judy Anderson from the English department. She was quite bored down there, because the only one thing she typed the professor's articles.
Oh.
So she wanted something different. So we hired her, and she said to me later on, I expect to be there with you about 2 or 3 years. She's still with us.
Huh.
So we have to celebrate her 30th year this coming Christmas. And she is a wonderful person. Very informal, and she has a way with students. Students like her, trust her, chat with her, and we all do. And she's very efficient. When we have problems, she says, well, I know somebody over in this, I'll call that person. So she makes life easier for the chair. By the way, it's when I was chair the first time that Mrs. Nielsen retired because she broke her leg, so I had some terrible chair, some terrible secretaries for 3 weeks or 5 weeks or something like this, and so we hired Julie. And Julie likes parties. And she thought we should have not secretaries there, you know, take out for drinks, but have a party for everybody. So she more or less started this famous group party. And she, the students help her, you know, the whole day, and you can smell this glögg wafting through the house. And people realize now we have the party, so they all show up. And it's wonderful because former students come and retired colleagues, so it's sort of a reunion party. Yeah. So that's more or less the story of
It belongs in the archives.
Sure.
Because it's very famous.
Sure. We both go into it pretty soon, in about a month or so.
One thing I wanted to ask related to the university is you are chair both when Donna Shalala, or you become chair shortly after she mm-hmm. has come, and then you must still be chair when David Ward takes over.
Right. And frankly, people like me, faculty members, even when you're chair, don't have much to do with the chancellors. You may listen to them now and then, you know, at big meetings, with faculty senate or something like this. But you try now and then to get them involved in major events.
Uh-huh.
For instance, when we hosted the annual Scandinavian conference here, we do that about every 10 years, 1990, again in 2000, you try to get one of these hotshots to introduce the event. And in 90 we got Donna Shalala to do that. And where it was, I forget, I think it was in the Historical Society. And she came walking in very fast. David Cronin once said, she's a fast moving target. And she gave a speech, very short, very eloquent, very fast. And she talked about that great Scandinavian called Wilhelm Tell. So now then we feel we shouldn't invite those hotshots. Or they should get better, you know, writers. Yeah. Script writers.
Uh-huh. Did you think, on balance, Shalala was good or bad for the university?
I think she tried to streamline things for good and for bad. I definitely think she was good. She's a good leader. I think so. She would be a lousy Indian, but a good chief.
Uh-huh.
And such people, strong as they are, and that goes to David Coleman too, you know, make mistakes. But also they are movers and shakers. And I was not surprised when she left for the Clinton administration. I didn't expect her to stay here.
Oh, didn't you?
I saw this as a stepping stone.
Uh-huh.
And I knew people who were acquainted with her from New York. I think it was Hunter College. Uh-huh. And they said, well, she is heading for politics. She won't stay with you guys. And she didn't.
Uh-huh.
And she didn't. Shane, I had never talked to. He was involved at the end game of the Brinkman case, and as you know, sided with Cronin.
Yes.
And I had hoped that he would not do that.
Right.
But you know, really, I don't know the man.
Uh-huh.
David Ward, I know faintly because I have friends in geography.
Oh.
Yeah, and also I was one of the evaluators of the geography department some years back. And Dave Ward once in company said, talk about email. He said, well, you know, it becomes rougher to be provost, with provost then, when you have email, because when you hand down a very unpopular decision to a department chair, that department chair will go straight into email and tell you off. Earlier, you wrote your draft on the typewriter, and then you amend it the next morning before you send it.
Yeah.
Now you get the straight, you know, cuss words. Well, it's funny little detail. Yeah. But somehow I think the faculty had more dealings with the award than with the other chancellors, the pros and chancellors. It was more visible to us. Do you
think that you being from Europe and David Ward being from Europe and immigrants into the American Academy, did that give you a special bond, or was that not relevant?
Well, we talked about it briefly, I think, because you're right, there are so many, not only Europeans, but so many foreigners here.
Yes.
That probably come here on a trial basis. They wonder, will I stay here? And so many of us have stayed here.
Uh-huh.
And when you get together with people like that, you know, you hit on that topic now and then. You do.
I would think so.
Yeah, and you also talk about the fact that you're not going to retire back home. You're very likely going to stay in America. And then you talk about how you talk about the fact that you have two cultures.
Uh-huh.
And I came up that topic now and then when I talked we were often invited, not often, but now we're invited to his home, you know, on
Overland House.
Yeah, which is a very pretty place.
Uh-huh.
And he was very good about sort of circulating and talking briefly to people.
Uh-huh.
He had a very good sort of society manner.
Uh-huh.
He was very good there, I think.
And was he a good chancellor?
In my opinion, yes, he was. I had the feeling that he was the right person to deal with the regents. Because that's what they have to do.
Yes.
And you know, all the regents were Republicans for quite a while because Tommy Thompson appointed them.
Yes.
And David Ward now and then told me about that he was very sorry that certain regents retired. The regents reconstructed the system and then new people could go on there.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think it was very rough for a liberal provost or chancellor to explain to the regents why we need this and that.
Uh-huh.
It was my hunch, I mean, talking to fellow faculty members who knew Ward better than I did, that Ward did a very, very good job there.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know what kind of job Shalala or Shane.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. It's interesting.
Yeah.
There's a wide range of opinions about Shalala and war that I have heard.
Yeah.
Any assessment of John Wiley, or is it too soon to tell?
It's probably too soon to tell, but he has a common touch. He also has, he finds it easier to talk to people. As a retiring chair or something like this, I was up there in the chancellor's house a couple of years ago, and once again, Wiley, like Ward, makes the rounds and talk to people. And I wonder, I mean, he and Ward, to me, resemble one another in their the common touch. So I wouldn't be surprised if Wiley, too, deals very well with the regions. But again, you know, I don't know Wiley, and I don't know people who know Wiley that well. There was an incident recently. Wiley was took the wrong step, but I forget what it was. I mean, something reported in the newspapers.
The Paul Barrow situation.
Yeah. That may not have been handled that well, but I'm too far removed for that. And also, since I spent, you know, half a year away from campus, I lose in touch.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there's one little incident I should tell you. I don't know much about honor societies because they don't exist in Scandinavia as such.
But oh, they don't?
No, they don't. But I know they're very important in this country and so on, and I have been invited to some of them to give talks. Then a colleague of mine who had interviewed me earlier on the radio, Emily Auerbach, called me and said, "Listen, Nils, you know, we need a new president for Five-Year Cup. And I think you're eligible." And I said, "No, I'm not. I have never been a member of that society. I don't know anything about it." "Well," she said, "according to my papers, you are eligible. Would you mind becoming president of Five-Year Cup?" I told that to my wife, who burst out laughing. "That's ridiculous," I said. "It's a joke." I said, "I don't think so." Well, apparently they needed somebody to preside over the next big meeting, the Phi Beta Kappa in this time, the yearly annual meeting where awards are handed out, you know, the teaching award and so on. And that somebody has to find a person to give a speech, and that person has to preside. And of course, say a few words here and there. So I became president of the Five-Year Cup and presided and asked Harold Shaw to give the speech for the occasion.
Oh.
And then I retired. So finally I was in contact with the honor societies.
Well, so now are you a member of Phi Beta Kappa now?
I am a member, yes. I am a member. I'll get the publication.
Sure. Oh, well, good.
Yes. Another thing I should mention is the fact that I stay very much in touch with former students, and many of them have become close friends. And that became very, very evident when I retired, because former students came to the event. It's November, 3 years ago I retired. They came to the event and sent email to me, and sent faxes and letters and whatnot, and they sent these emails and letters to Sue Grant, and my colleague, who was chair then, who read them aloud during the event.
Oh.
Very sweet. Very
you
touching.
Had not seen them.
No, I had not seen them. And then, after that, and my colleagues were very smart, because they got a grant from the Nordic Council for my retirement to have a folklore conference the day before.
Oh.
So there was a conference the day before, and that's now being made into a festival for me.
Oh, great.
It's coming out one of these days.
I would like a copy for the record.
Sure, I'll get you a copy. And since they got European money, not American money, they could use some of the money for a banquet. So they hired Kennedy Manor for the evening. Then we had a lovely, lovely dinner with wine and whatnot, and speeches. That was fun. It was. But then, during the next semester, where I was not working, I got messages from form students in particular and colleagues, where they want to come and give a lecture in the evening and maybe a faculty grad student seminar for an afternoon and things like that. So to do it sort of geographically, first I went to a library congress, and that was sponsored by the Danish embassy and some of the office out there about a year and a half ago. And then...
Was that thrilling?
Oh yeah, it was fun. It was fun. And of course I had friends out there to go for several days and spend some days with friends. Absolutely. And they're pretty generous, they paid pretty well. Then last October I went to Colombia to give a talk in the evening and teach a couple of classes. And that was kind of fun too, although that was the day that hurricane, which New York was rain, it poured down.
All the rain.
Yeah. But that was fun too. I was a former student, a PhD student of ours, who now teaches at Columbia. Then, let me interrupt myself. You know, you become the advisor for a PhD student, but in literature we try to involve the other professors as well. They read the drafts and the chapters too, so there won't be any nasty surprises for applicants. So we all sort of cooperate there. So many, many years ago, I was on this committee for a person in English who wrote about the Scandinavian ballads. And he's now a professor in Kalamazoo, Western Michigan. So Fish and I went there to give a couple of lectures. It was fun to Amtrak over there.
Oh,
yes.
Great.
More fun than flying.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
No question.
Then I have given talks at the Seattle, University of Washington, Seattle, Portland, and Tri-City usually already. So, you know, you get around some lecture circuits as a retired professor, which is kind of fun. It is.
Is that one of the unanticipated benefits of the academic life?
I didn't expect it. Yes, absolutely. 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 I don't think it'll continue, but who knows? But you'll find out. So that was a lot of travel.
Lots of your colleagues have talked about their PhD students, but I've never asked this. It is, in fact, a pretty intimate relationship,
yeah,
isn't
it? It is, because for 1 or 2 years, you see these people so often. And they often go to a Canadian country on a grant, ASF or Fulbright, and they have to get in touch with you from over there, so they have to send you what they write. And as a major advisor, you have to be pretty tough, because this dissertation should, first of all, qualify you for a job, should ideally be published either as a series of articles or as a book. So you can't let mediocre stuff fly by. So it can be, I mean, there you have some stress. Because now then you have to send people home and say, sorry, you have to read that.
Even as you like them.
Oh, yeah.
You say, this is not acceptable.
Right. So now then you have, you know, tears.
Really?
Yeah, and people wonder whether they can finish, or if they finish, whether they can ever get a job. And that's legitimate, because there aren't that many good jobs in Scandinavian studies. So they are aware of the name of the game. But in Scandinavian studies, we have had this policy that if somebody applies to grad school and says, I want to go all the way to a PhD, in other words, I want to teach, we have to be sure that this person can have it. Not only get a PhD, but get tenure. So we reject quite a few people.
And how do you make that decision?
It's hard, and you can be wrong. There's no doubt about it. So now then you have to tell the person who takes his or her MA studies, and often takes 2 years plus, because MA is pretty tough. It's also a qualifying exam for a PhD. If the person does not get honors, does not pass with honors, it's terminal with master's. Yes, you have a master's degree, but you can't go on here.
Is that unique to your department, or is that standard?
I think it's pretty standard by now, because departments have to have more or less the same criteria. Otherwise, if something falls behind, you know, they don't have respect.
Uh-huh.
But some of our people who only got pass went on to our universities and did not have it there. They might have gotten a PhD prep by, but they didn't get tenure later on. So I think our judgment is pretty sound.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But it's tough to call a person in. Well, it's tough because a person is called in for the three people who have been examining him or her for an hour and a half. So you passed the exam, congratulations, but you did not get high pass. You did not get honors. High pass is high pass.
And so they know.
They right know then. They have to bail out or do something else or apply somewhere else. Yeah, they know. So those who continue, you feel pretty sure that they'll have it. But they may not.
Mm-hmm.
So this can happen.
Has the issue of financial aid for your graduate students been an issue for Scandinavian studies?
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, earlier we had National Defense Money,
uh-huh.
You know, fighting the communists.
Yes.
But that money dried up eventually. We have some funding in the department. Torgo Thompson, a
uh-huh.
rich Scandinavian,
yes.
gave money to Scandinavian studies some years back. But most of that money was eaten up by the Torgo Thompson professorship. That's one of my jobs. The first time I was chair, I had to stop that and say the university has to pick up the rest of the bill
mm-hmm.
because we need fellowship money for students.
Mm-hmm.
And the university did that. So we had some Torgo Thompson money.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, there's some graduate school money, but not much. That's really one of the weak parts of this university, inadequate graduate funding. Just like the weak spot with sabbaticals. Sabbaticals not very good here.
Is it, I want to come back to sabbaticals. On the issue of graduate money, is it particularly bad for the humanities, or is it across the campus?
Well, it's probably across the campus, but my guess is that, say, the sciences, the hard sciences, have more access to federal funding.
Mm-hmm.
And those federal grants often come with, you know, student money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we are worse off. In social sciences and humanities, I think we are not well off in terms of graduate funding.
That was my question earlier that I forgot, which was, do you think that the humanities are fundamentally neglected by this university, or do you think that they are, in fact, well-regarded?
I think we are well-regarded.
Oh.
I think that both Ward and Wiley think highly of the humanities. And since I can compare this university to other universities, I think we're doing quite well. Not doing as well as we should,
uh-huh.
but doing quite well.
This is side two of tape five, Niels Ingerson. Niels, we got cut off there. You were saying that you thought compared, and I think we lost the comparison to the other universities. You were thinking that we did better than.
Better than places like Minnesota, University of Minnesota, and University of Washington, Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
That's my impression. I'm not saying we're doing well, because humanities, well, is always neglected a bit.
Yes.
Some years I felt that the salaries were pretty poor here in the 80s and the early 90s, but I have to say that they got better. During my last decade here, I felt that salaries were improving quite well in the humanities.
Really?
Yeah.
You felt fairly compensated?
Fairly, yes, I did. Also, I became Torgo Thompson chair, and
oh.
I think that added a bit too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But back to the issue of graduate school support, one of the reasons why we instigated these big service classes like Masterpieces and Hans Christian Andersen
mm-hmm.
and Ballad and Tale was that they would give us readerships and eventually TA-ships. And TA ships, that's our major source of funding for graduate students now. So most of the graduate students who come here have to teach 1, 2, 3, maybe even 4 years. Mm. And the TA ships have gotten better, but I have to say that they work pretty hard for that money. That's why often graduate school takes one more year.
Oh, I see. Yeah. The talk, you also made reference to the sabbatical program
here. Yeah.
Give us your critique of that.
Well, there is graduate school money for summers for younger people. And I got a fair share of those school summer supports my first 10 years here or so. Then it dries up, and it should. It's very good that young people can take summers off and work on some projects and not teach summer school. And also, that's graduate school funding for semesters off, for years off, especially for the younger people, and that's fine. Later on, you have to apply for sabbaticals. You have to apply. You don't get those sabbaticals automatically. Unlike my colleagues at UCLA and other places, they seem inundated with sabbaticals. A free quarter here and a free quarter there. We can have a sabbatical every 7 years, 1 year. But you're only funded for one semester, I think.
Really?
So you don't get the whole year.
You have to do the other semester?
Yeah, that's the other. That's the other. And the fact that you have to apply, I don't think this is quite fair. You weren't tired enough for 7 years to have a year off, I think. Because you have to read books again, read two.
Yeah.
Well, that's been a folklore too. It's common knowledge that when you've been chair, you are awarded a sabbatical.
Oh.
A semester. It's not in writing anywhere. That's common knowledge. Because I think that deans and provosts or whatever know that. Still, you have to write that proposal, and I wrote the proposal I wanted to award. I need to read books again. That was all. And I got most of that.
That's all you said?
So, fair enough. But, I mean, it's often you have to have sort of a major proposal for sabbatical. And I do not think that would be necessary. A big research place like this is well known that people work hard, and there's so many good teachers here. And people publish so much that every 7 years or some, or every 3.5 years even, you should have a full semester with full pay.
I take it, though, that the absence of that has not harmed the UW.
No, because people like to be here. I mean, I know so many people who come here from other universities. I won't mention them. But they say, oh, it's a relief to come to Madison. Partly because the university, as a rule, as I said last time, is well run. And there's a lot of faculty governance. And departments have a lot of autonomy. And it's a very pleasant place to live. It is. Madison is a wonderful place to live. It's a big little city.
Mm-hmm.
Theater life, music life, good restaurants, you can be out in nature in 10 minutes ago and so on. It is pleasant. It is very pleasant to be here. So a number of people are willing to, not say to cut, but to, they know if they left for Georgia or whatever, they would probably get 15,000 more a year. I mean, I know that for a fact.
Mm-hmm.
Because the person who lived in this house was associate professor in Samsung University. He'd just gotten tenure, and I had tenure for 5 years. He just got full professor. He earned 15,000 more than I did.
Mm-hmm.
But for the sake of the place, of the culture, the ambience, people stay.
Is that still true today, do you think?
Well, it is still true. But, you know, Madison is already being raided. I've seen very, very good people leave this place and go elsewhere. And But I had three offers. And I stayed here, but, and that was partly, you know, the feeling that this is a good place to be. Mm-hmm. I can be here partly. But I've seen some wonderful people disappear to other universities, even to Europe. Mm-hmm. And I know that Ward was dead tired of losing good people to other places. And we lost them because we could not match offers. Mm-hmm. A few years back, when Thompson left for Washington, he was very generous towards the university. Suddenly we had a lot of money, just like that in the 60s.
Really?
Yeah. And I must have talked to Bush.
Sarge Bush.
And he said something, I'm for the third time now, very briefly. Why we have enough money to raid other universities? And some of you people are going to retire soon. Maybe we could raid some full professors.
Huh?
So we raided the University of Washington. I called Tom Dubois, who was a very promising scholar in Finnish and folklore and Sami studies. And 10 years ago, I evaluated Washington, University of Washington, Seattle.
Yes.
And I told them then, you better promote Dubois as associate professor, because otherwise he would leave. They didn't do that.
Oh?
They didn't do that for some reason, because they were all associate professors, not full professors. So I called Tom Dubois and said, are you interested in coming to Madison? Maybe he's a full professor. Oh yes, of course I am. I like the department. And then we contacted Kirsten Wolf, who's been a Danish lecturer here about 15 years ago. She was now a full professor at Edmonton, University of Alberta, mm-hmm. in Old North, mm-hmm. Icelandic. And she was more than willing to come. That was fun. To raid other universities.
Did you get them both?
Got them both. That was a very good year, and that was fun. So they're now here, both of them, mm-hmm. part of the new crew.
Okay.
So we got in luck with one more FT than we had. And that was, doesn't happen too often.
Yes. Yeah. So that has to give you some satisfaction.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of, let me put it this way. Most of the time I walked to, driven to work, you know, feeling good about it. I mean, here's a wonderful secretary of project assistant, Julie Anderson. Colleagues you enjoy being with, you know, and over the years, lots and lots of wonderful students you still know. Mm-hmm. So it's been a gratifying life, absolutely.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Talking about rich and challenging times, though, you did make reference to September 11th, 2001.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, suddenly something happens that shakes you up and which shakes up the students. And as I told you before, when I was a soldier in Denmark, I was profoundly shaken when Kennedy was shot.
Yes.
Then came 9/11. I was at home here and I never watched TV in the morning or I don't listen to the radio. Then my Scott Miller called my right-hand man in Anderson and said, you better open for TV, something terrific has happened. So I saw the towers fall and all that. And at noon, 1 o'clock, it's about 11, I was going to teach my master thesis class. And I had about 180 students in there. And I knew from my TAs that many of these students were from East Coast. So I had to say something. Now, being in my 60s at that point, I was not that profoundly shaken because I have been through a number of things, shaking events.
Yes.
Not that you're jaded, but you're not that surprised. Anything can happen, you know that. So I had to figure out what to say to the students. Of course they're expecting me to say something. On the other hand, I also knew that they expected life to go on. So, I didn't know what to say. But now and then, you know, you do more or less the right thing. So I said, when I walked across on the highest to Bascom today to meet with you, normally I meet people who say, how are you, and I have a nice day. Nobody said that today. Because we all know that the worst possible that can happen has happened to us. And I said, I really look forward to mentioning today to you about the Scandinavian balance, about violence and murder. But now we are seeing violence and murder on the screen. And we all have trouble dealing with that. So if you want to leave this classroom and go and call your parents or friends in New York or wherever, by all means, do it. But they all stayed. He said, we know that the text I would like to talk about is a little bit, a text that shows something about the resilience of the human spirit. Yes, we are beaten back so often, but we always be always returned to life. And so on and so on. Then I went to my lecture.
Oh, yes, how wonderful. Were you yourself moved by your lecture?
Oh, yeah, sure. There are certain lectures, you know, that grab you.
Yeah.
And you could probably only do it once.
Yes, in a way, your life not as prepared just for that moment, but it is one of those moments.
It is one of those moments, sure. And I noticed afterwards that I had somehow a different relationship with the students. They came and talked to me after class, and my office hours and so on. And normally it doesn't happen in big lecture classes because they are, you're just the person up there on the podium.
Uh-huh.
And especially the TAs come and talk.
Really?
Because they would have to take all my roads sooner or later in life. But they're their duty teachers.
Sooner or later.
As I reflected afterwards on that hour, that very important hour, I also realized that I'm blessed in the sense that I'm teaching art. And in this class, I had just a few weeks ago or a few days ago talked about the magic tape. You know, the story starts with Once Upon a Time There Was.
Yes.
And then the hero or the heroine goes on a quest out in the wide, wide world, eventually passes tests and finds, you know, the ideal spouse, and then they live happy forever after. I mean, the point of that story is that you survive. You are the master of your fate. You succeed. It's a wonderfully positive message. And there's no culture in the whole wide world that doesn't have those stories. All cultures need those stories. And I think somehow that was the message I was sending that day to the students. And I think they got that. And they also got the point that what we're doing here in this class is not just entertainment, reading nice stories. No, art is really the magical helper you find in the magic tree, the one who comes to your assistance when you need it.
And that is the essence of the university life.
Sure it is.
I want to switch now, just for a moment, to your life post-retirement. You strike me as still rather committed and engaged. So for the record, if you would talk about what you're working on now.
Sure. I have, as I mentioned, written 7, 8, 9 articles on folklore, and perhaps the same number on Hans Christian Andersen. Mm-hmm. So it is tempting to put those articles between book covers. And whether that happened with Andersen, I don't really know. But I'm working on a narrative folklore project for a publisher in Wales and New York. I talked to one of the editors, and he read some of my stuff and said, why don't you develop that into a book? So it's not just, you know, taking the articles and writing them slightly probably rewriting. And it's more fun that way, because it's more creative. And after all, things have happened in folklore, in scholarship, since I wrote most of those things, most of those articles. It'd be called a need for narrative, a need for stories. So we just talked about the function of these old stories in people's lives. Mm-hmm. And it will mainly be about Scandinavian folklore, but I'm going to make digressions to folklore of the world.
Oh, great.
So the deadline is probably a year and a half from now, so I better start working. then, for smaller things, I gave a paper at UCLA at a conference about the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard and folklore. And very few people have worked on this. So that article, that talk I have to revise as an article for a folklore journal. Preferably before Christmas, we'll see. And then
Christmas this year?
Yeah, this year. But I think it starts this year. Then I was contacted by some editors who are working for the Modern Language Association, MLA.
Uh-huh.
They are going to publish a book on teaching literature and translation, which we are all doing, and have been doing for years and years and years. Because in masterpieces, probably 4 people out of the 180 can read the Scandinavian languages. And they never will. They only read these books in translation. Anderson, the same thing. So if you want to be a missionary from your culture, for your culture, you have to teach little translation courses. Now, some scholars feel that is sort of literary slumming. You have to know Russian to understand the beauty of Pushkin, and Spanish to understand Lorca, García Lorca.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know Russian, and I don't know Spanish, and I love to read Dostoevsky and Marquez. So I approve wholeheartedly of little translation courses, especially now that translations are getting better. They are. In the past, they were bad, 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 but now they're getting much, much better. So they asked me whether I would care to write about teaching Scandinavian literature and translation. And I said, yes, I will do that. And my first line is, enrollments matter. In other words, you know, you want to put enrollments in small departments, you have to teach living translation. And my last line will be, and now and then the students take your courses. They might decide to learn one of your languages. Just like what James Joyce did when he taught himself staying Norwegian to read Ibsen. And there are some passages in between I could not handle. I cannot write about children's literature because I don't know it, or Kalevala, Finnish folklore, so Tom Dubois, who I mentioned,
yes,
is writing that section.
Oh.
Isaac Dinesen is a specialty of Sue Bradley. She writes both in English and in Danish. So Sue Bradley writes those two pages about Isaac Dinesen, a bilingual author. And Dick Ringer, my Icelandic colleague, writes about Icelandic poetry. He's written a book about that. So it's a co-authored article, but I'm sort of the main author editor on the article. So I have those three projects.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Backburners, frontburners.
Yes. So you don't lack for things to do.
No.
Plus going to Denmark and then sure. Wyoming.
Sure. No, life is busy.
Life is busy. Quite busy.
And then I give guest lectures because my colleagues invite me to come back in and give talk. I mean, just been there today talking about Emerson.
Uh-huh.
So
do you do as much of that as you want? Or would you like to do more?
I do as much as I want.
Uh-huh.
I do. And as I want more, I could just ask for it.
Uh-huh.
So it's so sporadic, and that's just fine.
Okay. Just fine. Now, of course, you know, I want to ask you to tell the story of how you were the only member of the European nobility on the faculty at UW-Madison.
Well,
we would like the whole story.
The whole story, yeah. I was caught in 1991 by the Danish General Council in Chicago, who had ambassadorial rank. He then became the ambassador of Chile. Oh. Mr. Kidoik, whom I had known slightly because he liked to go up here and say hello, and he called me now and then about royal visitors and things like that. And he said, you have been proposed that you should be knighted the Ridder of Dannebrog. Dannebrog is the name of the Danish flag. Oh. And the Danish flag is very, very old. It's from the 11th century.
Really?
Yeah. And the story is this. The Danish Christian knights were in Estonia fighting the pagan, heathen villains. And the Danish bishop held up a cross to get victory. And his hands were very tired, so they sat down. And when his hands sat down on the cross, those heathens were winning, all the Christians. Then suddenly, from the sky came a flag that is red and white. That is Dannebrog, you know. Red and then a white cross in the middle.
Yes.
And the Danes won, of course, the battle. That's why Tallinn, Estonia, the capital of Estonia, is called the Danish Fortress.
It's founded by the Danes.
Yeah. Founded by the Danes. So this legend is behind this old, old, old flag. And the King or the Queen every year makes a number of people knights of Dannebrog. Now, how they got my name, I do not know. Who proposed me, I have no idea. When people ask me, I say, I have a hunch. Every summer, when I went back to Denmark, I did my lobby tour. I went to the Department of Education, to the Department of Culture, to the Fulbright Office, to the Nordic Council Office, and quite shamelessly pointed out that we need more money for Scandinavian studies in Madison. So I bought them, and they normally invited me out for lunch and gave me books and whatnot, and they knew me, sure. And it paid off. If you beg often enough, you do get some money. We got $25,000 once for our publication series here.
Oh.
And we also, they sent us a Danish lecturer for 3 years, and then for 3 years, and then for 3 years. So it did pay off to go and make a plane up yourself in these offices. At least they know. So, again, who proposed that, I do not know. But when a fellow from Chicago called me and said, you would be allowed. So I went up to my colleagues, quite so faithful, up to my colleague Sue Brandon, who was chair then, a very good chair, and said, they want me to be a knight. And she laughed, grinned, and said, we have to have a major event. So,
were you thrilled?
Oh yeah, sure I was thrilled. I thought it was fun. And then Sue Brandy arranged for a get-together in Van Hyde, she was up in the 19th floor, the place with the wonderful view.
Yeah.
And she invited David Ward and Gil Certain and Uzello and various other dignitaries to come there. And Kidderich, the general counsel from Chicago, came up. He was the one who handed it to me. And then Ward and Phil and Uzello gave nice little speeches. And I gave a nice little speech too and talked about Gilbert and Sullivan?
Oh, yeah, Gilbert and Sullivan.
Talk about what kind of people you get, you know, crosses and stars and whatnot. The fools, the fools, the fools. So we had a splendid little event up there, and some people gave me roses, and students collected signatures, and it was wonderful. It was, you know, a sweet, sweet, sweet event. And then that night we went to the Great Dane up on the square, you know, and had another one of these, our partners, you know.
Did you go to Denmark? Did you meet the king? Or queen?
I was supposed to. The trouble is, when I go to Denmark, the queen is always going to Greenland or some other place. You know, she's never there during the summertime.
Oh.
But I am supposed to write my autobiography and send it to the office. And I haven't done that yet. Another thing I should do now. But it became sort of a major ruckus because the journalists were there too. And the state journal had me on the front page the next day. So people in the neighborhood said, "What are you, a king or somebody?" Still happens.
Was your brother thrilled?
People in Denmark thought it was fun. They did. Yeah, sure. So I get teased a lot in the elevator. People call me sir. In the Auerbach called me sir. It says on this tape, you know, of Anderson, sir, Miss Anderson.
I think that's great.
So, I'm still teased.
This concludes the oral history interview with the quite extraordinary and quite charming Emeritus Professor Niels Ingridsson, Emeritus of Scandinavian Studies. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.